A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name's Mike Calvin. I'm joined by Dave Kidd of The Sun and Seb Stafford-Bloor of Football 365. Welcome, one and all, to a winter break with a difference. They still play football. Four Premier League matches this weekend. The rest follow a week later. It at least gives us a chance to take stock. Liverpool will win the title, of course. According to Pep Guardiola, they're unstoppable. Now, he's taken inferiority really badly. I get that he's a perfectionist, but a question has to be asked. Is he losing the plot, Dave?
Well, I think he's remarkably, always has been remarkably touchy towards criticism. And most managers are, probably most people are, and he certainly fits that bill. The idea that he locked his players in the dressing room for 50 minutes to tell them how good they were, which is the line he came out with, is probably a little bit, you know, unlikely. I think Guardiola, it's a ridiculous thing to say when you would expect them to beat Aston Villa and pick up the sixth out of the last seven domestic trophies to be handed out, to be talking about a club that's slightly drifting and a manager whose future is long-term future is uncertain. But you do get the feeling that City need a major, particularly defensive overhaul in the summer, that you could argue they need to sign an entire back four with Laporte, obviously. So then possibly need two other options at centre-half and a couple of full-backs at the very least. And there are various other members of that squad who are not getting any younger. It is really a question now, I think, of whether Guardiola has the energy and the long-term vision for City to undertake that overhaul. Because although they have been a wonderful team, and they still are on their day a wonderful team, they haven't been doing it consistently enough, and they are so far behind Liverpool that they need a major restructure of the squad in the summer. Mm. Is Guardiola that man? History suggests he doesn't tend to stay around for longer than four or five seasons. He has one more year on his contract. We'll see. You know, he generally will be a man who will honour a contract, but beyond that, I'd be surprised if he signed another deal.
Yeah, because when he was at Barcelona, he basically spoke of his 4 years there as an eternity.
Yeah.
Direct quote. There does seem to be a sense of stasis at City. Is he a reflection of that? Has he contributed to that?
I don't know. I mean, when I watch City at the moment, I see vaguely what they were before, but aside sort of littered with mental errors. I think that was shown quite clearly yesterday. Sort of this Zinchenko moment and some of the decisions his players made. I feel like I don't even necessarily attribute this purely to Guardiola. I think as an organisation, there is this emphasis on the Champions League. And I think even if it's subliminal, even if it's unintentional, over time, that's going to be reflected in your domestic performances. I think this is a mistake because I really, Man City, are they actually going to be good enough to compete with teams at the very top of the European game at the moment? I mean, the idea that they're saving themselves for the Champions League and that, you know, this is the sort of the direction of organisational focus, that will probably leave them empty-handed because at the moment, OK, Tottenham have a little bit of a psychological hold over them, but there are huge problems in defence, there are issues in midfield. They look like a side who've been a little bit overthought, but also a group of players who seem almost bored of playing together. Staleness is the kind of the word we throw around, and that feels very, very appropriate at the moment.
Mm. Do you feel that their season hinges on that Champions League two legs against Real Madrid?
Yeah, I think for City, and weirdly for Guardiola personally, his record in the Champions League, by his ridiculous standards, for best part of 10 years now, he's been 9 years, he hasn't reached a final, I'm pretty sure I'm right in saying. And for City, it's obviously the great, it's, you know, it's the final frontier. They've only ever reached one semi-final when they were very poor against Real Madrid. I think they only lost 1-0 on aggregate, but they were remarkably poor and unambitious under Pellegrini. They've got, you know, that's the great hurdle. That's, you know, I think last season we, you know, were saying that Liverpool wanted more than anything to win the Premier League, City more than anything to win the Champions League, and they each got each other's, you know, desired prize. This year, you know, Liverpool are clearly going to win their first Premier League title. Can City make that breakthrough of Champions League? I tend to agree with Seb in that it's very difficult to switch on and off. They didn't play badly in either of their last two games, including the second leg against United, but they dominated games, but couldn't score a goal, never mind win. And I do think that it's a squad that does need freshening up. It's really surprising that they didn't bring in a centre-half in the summer. Even more surprising they didn't do so in January. At least one defender and a left-back, I would say, as well. We saw again Zinchenko yesterday. He's not top draw. When you're on a yellow card like that, I didn't think there was actually a real desperate need to make that challenge. It was obviously a tactical foul, but you know, when you're on a yellow and your team's on top, it totally changed the momentum of the game, I thought. Although, having said that, the tetchier that game got, I thought the more likely Spurs were going to win it because Mourinho thrives on that sort of negative energy that was bubbling around in the first half, and you suddenly thought, hang on, Spurs are going to win this. But it was obviously the red card that really did change things.
So, Seb, is it simply a case of him being out-coached by Jurgen Klopp?
I'm loath to use that description because I feel like he hasn't... I don't feel like that's a direct comparison. I feel like he hasn't got a solution for what Klopp does at the moment. I also think, interestingly, this is kind of why he can't bolt. I know Dave mentioned it already, like he has this habit of short cycles and not staying in the same place for any great period of time. But if he were to leave at the end of this season, for instance, he is almost, in that kind of binary way, being defeated by Klopp. What I think will be interesting is what his response is. So when City go into the summer, again, Dave's touched on this, that squad needs freshening up, needs enlivening. He needs a, for want of a better description, a new set of toys to do something with, just to regenerate some ideas, but also some enthusiasm in the football. So if we're talking about this in a year's time, and with City's resources and they're reaching the transfer market, he is still in the same position. Yeah, I'd say so. But for the moment, it's a process. He needs the opportunity to react to what Liverpool have been this year.
Mm. What is Liverpool's next phase, Dave? Are they in the market for someone like a Kylian Mbappe? You know, there's been some talk of 253 million. With a player like that, with a marquee player like that, are Liverpool ready for someone like that? Because everything they're doing at the moment is collective, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm saying they wouldn't be ready for it. I mean, they're Liverpool. They're, you know, six-time champions of Europe. They're the runaway Premier League leaders and the champions of the world. So, I mean, they'd be perfectly big enough club to have Mbappe there. Whether that's the sensible footballing thing to do, I doubt. But they have got their recruitment spectacularly. You know, they've done it spectacularly well in the last few years. When they've signed, you know, their big marquee signings, they've been on players they absolutely needed, Alisson and Van Dijk in particular. I don't think signing Mbappe is necessary, despite the fact he could be, you know, as good a player as there is on the planet and probably will be very soon. I don't think he is a player that will improve Liverpool, because how can you improve them? That front three has been outstanding for several seasons now. I still think the midfield could get slightly better. That's the only thing I can think of. It's bordering on perfection, as the results suggest. They win every single game, even when they're not playing particularly well. Even the Wolves outplayed them for quite large spells the other week, and you always felt Liverpool were going to win because they always do. It's an extraordinary psyche they've got there under Klopp. As for the next phase, I mean, that's always what we've been talking about. City, they were obviously incredibly good the last 2 years in terms of the beauty of their football, as good as anything we've seen in the Premier League. But after a certain amount of time, you know, sustained success, you do need to regenerate at some point. I don't think Liverpool have got there yet. Liverpool's age profile is very good. There aren't any players in their first choice 11 that need refreshing in terms of age. It's an interesting one. I mean, you know, Ferguson always famously did want to bring in a player or two every summer, even when they were walking the league. I'm sure Liverpool will do the same, but I wouldn't say Mbappe at the moment.
Mm. What they've got, though, they improve. So if you look at, let's take as a case in point, Joe Gomez. He, over the last 2 to 3 months, has been the best central defender in England. Is that because of his latent talent and he's now free of injury, or is that because of the culture that Klopp has instilled at the club?
I think it's both. I'd add a third in there. I think playing next to Virgil van Dijk is a really, really good thing for Joe Gomez, because I think a centre-half is always prisoner to his circumstances. Who's his goalkeeper? Who's the full-back outside of him? Who's the centre-half inside of him? And Gomez is... All the things you mentioned are absolutely true, mate. Like, he had terrible luck with injury, and that was really the obstruction to what, you know, hopefully will be a fantastic career. But you go into a situation which is very stable alongside a partner who can recover from almost anything. And the security and confidence that must give you as a player is amazing. It's like, for someone like Alisson, when he came into the team, to have Virgil van Dijk ahead of him as well, now to have Gomez, the confidence that if you do make a mistake, there is someone to mop it up and to make it kind of irrelevant. That's very, very helpful. And the result of that is nearly always a kind of a spike in performance. And Gomez has gone from someone who, okay, you might shuffle into sort of England's right back position if you need to you're going to be starting at the European Championship. And arguably, I'd say he's had a much better season than Harry Maguire. He's England's first choice at the moment, really.
And there's someone who was recruited for £3.5 million.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You've got Maguire at £80 million.
Yeah.
Is he symbolising one of many symbols of what's going wrong at Manchester United at the moment? You know, we always ask who's won the transfer window. Well, it's certainly not been Ed Woodward, is it?
No, but I think Maguire has had a decent season.
He's been OK, hasn't he?
He's been made captain, and I think that's a good decision, even if it actually reflects badly on United's recruitment that a guy who's only been there for 6 months gets the captaincy of Manchester United. He still is a very good candidate as captain. He's a good leader. He's not been flawless. He never has been. He's always had a mistake in him. 80 million was always too much. That's not Maguire's fault. So I wouldn't say he was a symbol of their decline. I'd say he was something they've got pretty much right. I thought a couple of their, in fact, probably all three of their summer signings were decent signings. It just shows how far they've got to go, that they're still, you know, a distant fifth or sixth place, or sixth, I think, in the Premier League. United's transfer window, Bruno Fernandes looks like a good signing already. What I've seen of him in Portugal and what I saw of him the other night, he looks like he's a positive player. He looks like he wants to shoot. And there's been times you watch Man United and you thought, why are they all so scared just to have a dig? Fernandes certainly hasn't got that problem. Odion Ighalo is obviously someone that's, you know, there's been sort of great mirth about his signing. I felt that if Spurs had signed him in Kane's absence, everyone would have said, well, actually, it's not a bad stopgap signing, really, for Spurs. You know, it's better than not having a centre-forward. It gives you that option. I don't think it's the worst signing for United. Obviously, we expect them to go out and do more. And the United of old would have signed Haaland and got the best young striker in Europe, who can't stop scoring for Dortmund, you know, for two or three games. He's got 7 goals, I think, or something. Yeah. But United are not at that level anymore. They can't necessarily just go out and attract those sort of players.
Because, you know, there's a horrible phrase in football, a body, and that is what Ighalo is, in essence. Get him in for 6 months. OK, so we have to pay £165,000 of his £300,000 that he's getting in China. It's not his fault, but should Manchester United supporters expect more?
Yes, I think so. I mean, there's two separate parts to this. Firstly, Odion Ighalo is actually a very nice story. He is a childhood Manchester United fan and he's fulfilling a dream. I think that's a one part of this. The other is I feel as if Manchester United have had a long time to prepare for this. They made the decision in the summer to let Romelu Lukaku go, which, irrespective of what happened to Marcus Rashford over the course of the season, is very similar to the Kane scenario at Tottenham. Like, there is a risk of injury, there is a lack of cover in the centre-forward position, and someone should have done something about that. Actually, it seems as if the Lukaku decision was made a long time before the summer by Solskjaer. Didn't obviously want him at the club. He made that particularly clear. And yet there wasn't the attempt to bring in a player of any particular profile. The Haaland situation presented itself, but there was no, right, let's have the 20-year-old player who, okay, like Dave says, Man United can't just go and flash their crest at players anymore and just seduce them that way. But there is definitely the opportunity to bring in a player over the summer who can grow into a role, who can really understudy someone like Marcus Rashford or compete in one of those sort of those front three roles, because a lot of forwards these days don't just occupy one position, so it's actually even easier to fill that position. And so having done, I agree with Dave completely, I think Bruno Fernandes is a good player. I don't know quite how good he is yet because I'm not sure what Portugal is as a league. But he looks good. I watched the game on Saturday. But having done that, you've kind of, instead of finishing a transfer window on a good note, you've kind of took yourself back to where you were a year ago. And it's kind of sort of reactionary, muddled thinking. And you've got people saying things like, right, where's the director of football? Why is there not more focus on this? Who is in our organisation who is tracking these problems? Who's monitoring things like Marcus Rashford's workload? And fairly, people are right to ask those questions. And yeah, so it's a kind of snatching defeat from the jaws of victory situation, unfortunately.
The whole transfer window for me was, you know, the story of it was people not doing the bleeding obvious.
Yeah.
Tottenham needed a striker, they didn't sign a striker. Yep. Manchester United needed a better striker than a guy, they didn't get one. Chelsea needed various different things because and they had a band. You just expected Chelsea to go out and sign two or three players, left back, probably up front. Yep. Didn't do it. Manchester City glaringly needed a centre-half, didn't do it. You sort of slightly wonder what all these people on transfer committees or directors of football are actually doing with themselves at major clubs. Whereas Liverpool, when they've got, we need a centre-half, they sign a centre-half. When they need a goalkeeper, they sign a goalkeeper. It's not rocket science. These clubs just haven't had the wherewithal to bring in the right players.
Well, it's about, you know, a strategic commitment to their craft, isn't it? Mm. You know, if you look at Liverpool and Minamino, they've been watching him for 18 months. Mm. It's interesting, you spoke about the director of football role at Manchester United, Seb. Someone I know was approached about that role. Mm-hmm. And with the merest look at it, he said, they haven't got any conception what that is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So why would I get involved? Now, does that tell you everything about the football club? That they don't, you know, it's a nice shiny title, but they don't really know what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's a, I think what it suggests to me, and this is a little bit conspiratorial, is that the focus is not on performance and it hasn't been for a really, really long time.
Well, they couldn't wait on Twitter on Sunday morning to start selling the Bruno Fernandes shirt. They were posting on Twitter, get your
Fernandes. And by the time we finish this podcast, he'll have his own emoji somewhere. Like, you know, this is what Manchester United are. On the one hand, like, we all object to that because this is kind of new and this is a culture which has crept into the game. In reality, it's an imperative of modern football. These are the things that clubs do to create a financial advantage. At the same time, club of Manchester United's size, there is no real reason why those two things can't, why those two imperatives can't coexist, why you cannot have this very prolific commercial enterprise alongside a properly run sporting entity, which is not just a sporting director, is not just a guy that sort of points a finger at a nice, shiny football player. It is someone who oversees all kinds of departments. It's analytics, it's medical, it's recruitment, it's everything. It is a huge job. And if this was a FTSE 100 company and you had a company that was known for producing a particular product and there was no oversight of the production of that product, what would you say? Mm. And it's really no different. I know football is a bit unique in the sense that everyone thinks they can do it and it's kind of, oh, well, you know, we've all played on Championship Manager and we, you know, how hard can it really be? I've never felt like Manchester United take this seriously enough, at least not in this era, like this responsibility and all the functions of that position. They just have a fundamental disrespectful to me.
They're like the Real Madrid Galactico era without the Galacticos. The one Galactico they've got is always injured and sulking.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And speaking of emojis, with Pogba, how do you see all that playing out?
He'll leave in the summer and he'll do brilliantly because he's a brilliant footballer. Yeah. And he should never have gone back there in the first place. I feel a bit sorry for him. I think he has been let down by the club, by the way the club's been run. He's not a good enough player, who, apart from Ronaldo and Messi, who are, to make an ordinary team outstanding. But he's a very, very good player, a world-class player. And I think he'll go to Juventus or Real Madrid. And I think it may, with Fernandes actually happening, if Pogba had been fit in January, they may well have done it then. And I can't believe he'd possibly be there next season.
Mm. With Chelsea, you mentioned, you know, they didn't get anyone in. Where does that leave Frank Lampard?
Well, ideologically, Lampard's tied to what Chelsea continue to do. Like, he is... I mean, it probably suits Lampard to the club not to sort of immediately return to the days of, you know, big-ticket recruitment. But as much admiration as I have for the clutch of talent, players like Abraham and Mount and Reece James, who I think is one of the best of the lot, actually, Tomori, I think it's left Lampard slightly exposed, because I think that he's now taking a risk with Champions League qualification. I don't necessarily think recruiting is his fault, because I still, unbelievably, have no clear sense of what the recruiting dynamic is at Chelsea. I know that eventually Petr Cech will grow into that role, but as far as I can, as I understand it, he's kind of learning on the job and evolving as an employee in that sense. I think it potentially weakens his hand. I think if he finishes the season with Chelsea back in the Champions League, I think that's more than good enough for a first year in the Premier League. If he doesn't, then all of a sudden, given what that club has been for 15 years, given what they've grown used to, I think it makes his job a little bit harder, much harder, in fact.
What's your report card on him,
Dave? I think Lampard, personally, rather than Chelsea as a club, would rather that the ban hadn't been lifted in the first place, and then he could have carried on with the feel-good factor of the kids. When the ban was lifted, there was hope and expectation amongst Chelsea support that they would sign a couple of key players. Probably centre-half, left-back, I'd say a lot of people would be after more than a striker, but yeah, another striker maybe.
Goalkeeper.
Certainly a goalkeeper, absolutely, yeah.
That was a brave manager.
It was, yeah, brave, but almost, it was almost becoming, you're watching Chelsea and thinking, this guy never seems to save anything, really, Kepa. Yeah, it was brave, but it almost became inevitable, apart from the fact, you know, we know Caballero's a bit flaky as well, so yeah, a goalkeeper as well. Once the window... Once the embargo was lifted, you know, the fact that Chelsea didn't do anything, then it's probably going to lessen that feel-good factor that was around that sort of reconnection we have with Chelsea's roots and the youth players coming through and Lampard coming back. And it was remarkable going to a lot of Chelsea games early in the season when Chelsea weren't winning at home and everyone was really delighted with how it was going. It was quite refreshing, really. But once that ban's lifted, it's not Lampard's fault personally. He's not personally in charge of recruitment. But there's going to be a little bit more an edge and frustration about Chelsea support because they haven't been able to get transfers over the line in January when they were able to do so. Particularly if that gap with Spurs in particular, maybe, or United, starts to lessen even more because they haven't got a big cushion now with fourth place. So, yeah, it's really not ideal for Lampard. But I think he's doing a decent job. And I think what's happened in January doesn't help him.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of goodwill towards him, isn't there?
Well,
what about his handling of Giroud? He's just become a non-person, hasn't he?
I don't understand that. I mean, I think Giroud is probably one of those people that has grown a little bit better in his absence. At the same time, as a plan B, is there a better option in the Premier League? Like, as someone that if you need to be a little bit more direct, if you need a... I mean, Giroud's actually, he's got a little bit more craft than he's given credit for with the ball. And I've watched Chelsea quite a few times. I've been at quite a few of their games at home where they fail to deliver, where they've had that same problem each time where they just run into the teeth of an opposing defence, which is like tightly packed. I haven't heard a decent explanation for it. It's one thing to say, Tammy Abraham is my guy, we're going forward with him. I'm all on board with that. But it seems as if Giroud has actually been kind of forcefully disenfranchised. I mean, it's not like he's on the bench. He's actually been left out of squads now for, I'm not quite sure how long it is, but quite a while, a significant period of time. And I don't know. I mean, I have no explanation for that. I don't see the rationale behind it, certainly.
Mm. Can I just go back to goalkeepers, Dave, if I may? You know, it's said that Frank Lampard fancies Nick Pope at Burnley, who has a credible claim to be regarded as probably England's number one at the moment. Mm. With the European Championships in mind, where is Gareth Southgate's thinking going about his goalkeeper?
Yeah, it's interesting. Always interesting with England calls because you have such a long gap between the November break and the March. It's like 4.5 months without, you know, an England match, and during that time, the fluctuations in form and fitness of several players, most players, is immense. So, I think he's got a lot of loyalty and a lot of affection for Pickford, but Pickford, I would say, is probably less reliable than Pope. He likes Pickford's ability with his feet, distribution, but. And he likes his character, but Pope's, I think, got a genuine chance of starting at the Euros now. He's been very, very solid. I like the look of him. I'm not surprised Lampard's interested. I mean, Kepa was a huge amount of money, wasn't he, when he came in,
74 or something.
It's an extraordinary amount of money for a keeper who simply hasn't looked the part. And, you know, we shouldn't forget the League Cup final fiasco last season. It was one of the most embarrassing things I've ever seen on a football pitch. So it hasn't worked out, and Lampard's right to want to rectify it.
Mm. Yeah, speaking of goalkeepers, Hugo Lloris gave a certain solidity to Tottenham against City. Was that the result that maybe eased some of the angst about Jose Mourinho as well?
I think from the mood in the stadium, it was a result which signified the beginning of something. I think it'd be a mistake to portray that as a good Tottenham performance. I've also seen words like masterclass thrown around quite liberally. Nothing I saw yesterday really fitted that description, because City actually played very well. They just couldn't finish, and Tottenham were pretty limited and still have some very obvious flaws. I think what happened yesterday was an emotional engagement, a kind of a collective buying in into whatever this Mourinho project is, because it's probably the most involved that stadium has been in a Tottenham performance since probably, I'd say, the Champions League quarterfinal first leg against City last season. That was not turning point, but a building block. I don't know. I still don't know what Mourinho is at Spurs. I mean, we're all dwelling at the moment in kind of superficial details, like sort of memes that appear on Twitter of him laughing about, you know, missed penalties and him and João Sacramento running towards technical areas, that kind of stuff. And at the moment, I don't feel like there's a fully formed idea behind this Spurs team. There's some good players. Lo Celso is a fabulous footballer. He's absolutely brilliant. Jafet Tanganga is a lovely human being, seemingly, from his interviews, and a great story, but he's doing ever so well in what is not his natural position. So there is the beginning of something. What that something is, no idea. Absolutely no idea. That's the kind of insight you wanted me on for.
What about first impressions on Steven Bergwijn?
Yeah, I mean, relatively quiet. He made a really good tackle early on, didn't he, from Walker. But it was a brilliant finish, an absolutely brilliant finish. And obviously, you know, it was Tottenham's first shot of the match in the 63rd minute, and he took it. City had missed 14 chances before that, or had 14 attempts not scored. He got one chance and, you know, brilliant. Chest down, swivel, bang. Really, really good finish. And
Dave, do you see him in the first half when he, about sort of 35 minutes in, when he was playing right on the near touchline next to the press box, and he just looked knackered. Absolutely knackered.
Yeah. It didn't look like it was going anywhere with debut, really, at that point. Absolutely. The sort of intensity of the Premier League encapsulated, you know, for a new signing. But then, what a finish. And, I mean, I have my doubts about Mourinho long term. I don't think it felt. I agree about the connection, but I think that connection came from the negative energy of the VAR and the anger, and everyone was up for it. And Mourinho does thrive on that sort of the world's against us. And that, I think the fact that the VAR decisions finally in the City Spurs games finally went the other way in City's favour kind of got everyone, you know, really up for it, and that helped. I don't see. Tottenham Hotspur is a football club with a very specific historic tradition, which is very rarely veered away from the glory game of Danny Blanchflower. It's very rarely strayed away from that. Mourinho is the absolute antithesis of that and always will be. Therefore, I don't see it being a successful long-term project. I still think he can always frustrate the hell out of the best teams in the world. But I agree, I don't think it was a masterclass. It was more to do with luck and a feeling of this sort of righteous indignation about the VAR decisions than any sort of great, you know, tactical nous of Mourinho's yesterday.
Yeah. So in that context, how important is Wednesday's FA Cup tie against Southampton? Is it critical to the season?
Yeah, absolutely, because at the moment, Tottenham just needs to stop winning. Like, the more games you win, the more belief there is. I think you need to create some sort of momentum. I don't even think it's important in the sense of, right, let's go and win a trophy. It's let's get this habit back of, you know, yesterday's game, it felt like a little bit of an outlier. I don't see it necessarily instructing anything, because it was all so random and weird. It's one of the most bizarre games of football I've seen all season. There was no real rhyme or reason to it. I feel like they have to get back into the habit of knocking over teams like Southampton, the sort of the automatic victories. irrespective of what competition that's in and what it leads to, you need to be in a position where you keep clean sheets, you score goals, you create chances, and then you move forward, because that was the great virtue of the Pochettino era.
I think for Mourinho in particular, it's about winning trophies.
Oh, for sure.
And it will look good on his CV. And quite frankly, he's in tune with fans of Spurs and every other club there. Fans want to win domestic knockout trophies. It's the bean counters who don't necessarily care about it because it's not that profitable. But Mourinho wants that. That's one respect where he is in tune with the glory thing, because the glory of winning trophies is something that that feeds, obviously, his ego and his CV.
Do you think he'll get them to chase down Chelsea?
Possible, but without Kane, I think unlikely. Without a centre forward, I think unlikely that they'll be able to do it consistently enough. But Chelsea are vulnerable. I quite fancy Wolves, but
I do.
Wolves are the best team I've seen out of that clutch of teams who could finish fourth.
Completely.
It's whether they have the depth when they get back into Europa. You know, that's they seem to have struggled with that, with juggling those earlier in the season. So we'll see.
We shouldn't overlook the team that actually is fifth, Sheffield United, which is extraordinary when you think about it. They had a good transfer window, it seemed to me, with Sanderberg coming in from Genk. He seems born for the Premier League.
So, I mean, if you were to build a Premier League midfielder in a laboratory, you'd end up looking like that. 6'4", good feet, progressive, physically capable of matching anything that you'll find in the league. Just go back quickly. I'd like to put my hand up for Dean Henderson as England goalkeeper. I think he's been brilliant this season. I know he's made a high-profile error or two, but he is. I think he'll be the natural successor to Jordan Pickford before much longer, as and when he goes back to United. Sheffield United, I think Chris Wilder is one of the great stories this season. I think, when teams get promoted into the league, there's always that sort of 2 or 3 months where it's all novelty and they work hard and they knock over a couple of big teams and people over-celebrate them. In this instance, what they've shown is an ability to do that, absolutely, to rattle a few cages. They're a fundamentally good side, not just in the sense of their integrity. They're good to watch. They're really well built. And Berg, I was talking to Cal on Twitter. I followed Blaze Pod, who, our Sheffield United podcast. And one of the biggest virtues of that team has been their midfield of Norwood, Fleck, and Lundstrom. So I'm interested in long term how that dynamic is disrupted and what Berg will bring that someone like Lundstrom hasn't been able to, because I think he's been great. He's a little bit of a tailing off recently, but all three of those players have been magnificent this season. I said to you before we started recording, Mike, I love the idea that he went there. That he didn't just say, I'm going to go and sit on Chelsea's bench for 3 years and then get loaned somewhere or whatever. He goes, I will play for, I will go to a sort of an unfashionable club, a newly promoted side, and I will buy into what Chris Wilder, who is probably different from sort of, it's probably for, he's not a name, is he? He's not a Lampard or a Guardiola or a Mourinho. He's someone that, clearly Berg has sat down and listened to and learnt about his vision for the future of Sheffield United. He's bought into it. And it's great. And, I can't wait to see what Sheffield United do next, actually.
I think with Wilder, if he looked like Marco Silva, he'd be managing Arsenal or Tottenham by now.
Completely agree.
That's a little bit of a sort of thing Allardyce might have said about himself a few years ago, and I wouldn't necessarily agree with it about Allardyce. I think Wilder's body of work is outstanding.
Absolutely.
Absolutely outstanding throughout the leagues.
Because a lot of the praise for him has been pretty patronising.
Yeah, and it's not as if they're an effective long ball team if they're another Stoke or Burnley or something like that. They're not. They play some really good stuff. It's really well structured. It's exciting to watch.
It's expressive isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. And you enjoy watching them, and they've sustained it over the course of 2/3 of a season now. And Wilder's record is magnificent. If he looked and sounded differently, he would be one of the biggest clubs in the world, because that record is that good. Mm.
They're at home on Sunday to Bournemouth.
Yeah,
two clubs travelling in different directions. Mm.
Both won at the weekend, which surprised me a little bit. I don't know. I still feel as if once Bournemouth get a couple of players back, particularly David Brooks, then they will pull clear, because Brooks is a super player and his injury has really hurt them. Lloyd Kelly as well, who was one of their big signings over the summer, really, really promising left back. But in terms of, it feels more like Bournemouth have reached the end of whatever the Eddie Howe era is. It feels like Eddie Howe is still a very capable coach, and he will continue to be for goodness knows how long. But it feels as if there isn't quite as much energy left in the journey. And I think it wouldn't surprise me to see a parting of ways in the summer. But Sheffield United, there's an originality to them. I think Eddie Howe and Bournemouth have become one of those clubs that sort of, they have a certain profile of player that they want to recruit, which is good. It's good to have a kind of a model. Sheffield United are just a bit bolder. Like, there doesn't seem to be any kind of inhibition. You know, they'll take a chance from Ravel Morrison, when, to be fair, a lot of clubs would just say, I don't want that problem. Jack Rodwell too, ditto, given his appearance in the Sunderland documentary.
Morrison's soon gone to Middlesbrough.
Morrison has, but it's like the intent, isn't it, Mike? It's the kind of, it's even, like, going back to Sander Berg, it's the idea that you fancy your chance of getting a player like that, someone that's been connected with Man United and Chelsea. You say, I'll have a go at that. Even a lot of clubs could literally afford to pay him and sign him, but not many would say, no, we'll actually go and do it. And I think that makes it, that gives all neutrals a little bit more enthusiasm for what Sheffield United are. Bournemouth, we kind of got used to, and it's plateaued. Hasn't held their attention quite the same way.
There's a glass ceiling, isn't there, for clubs of that size? And we saw it with Charlton under Kirbyshley, we saw it for Fulham, we saw it for Swansea. In their different ways, they all got to that stage as smaller Premier League clubs, finishing consistently in the top half for 3 or 4 years. But there's nowhere to go almost. I mean, I know anything can happen when Leicester's win the league under Ranieri, but that's, you know, once in a lifetime. Those clubs, where do you go once you've finished 7th, 8th, 9th consistently and been this great model of a well-run club? It's things just naturally, you know, if you can't improve and you can't go forward, at some point you're probably going to end up slipping backwards.
Mm. Can you say the same thing about Crystal Palace? Now, they're against Everton in the BT Sport match on Saturday. Mm. Roy Hodgson is obviously very frustrated. They had a terrible window. Yeah. No one, apart from Tosin going there on a 6-month loan. Yeah. He sounds at the end of his tether with what's going on at that club.
Yeah, I mean, he's overachieved as he always does at smaller clubs. He's done a very similar job to what he did at Fulham and West Brom. Yeah. Fulham particularly spectacular because of the Europa League run, but what he does is he overachieves at clubs like that and gets them into mid-table and well safe of relegation. It's not often wonderful to watch. It's always pretty tight at the back. It's the old two banks of four, and we've seen it for years and years. But he's a master at doing it. But he needs a bit of help from upstairs. So I'm really sorry. The Ferguson, isn't it? The fullback. It's a really good player. That was very close. It must have been very frustrating that one collapsed late on. But yeah, it's a club that needs a bit of re-energising. Not necessarily the manager, but he is 72, I think. 70. You know, at some point, you know, I really thought after England that would be him done, and I'm really always massively impressed with the sense of energy that keeps him out there. And he is very much a hands-on training ground coach day in, day out, that he never seems to tire of it. And he never seems to tire of drilling players in the same way that he has been doing for decades.
Yeah. They're at Everton. You saw Everton on Saturday. Mm. How did they win that game?
I have no idea. Honestly, it's one of the... great respect to them for their comeback. It was very dramatic. But I didn't have a single positive thing to write about it because it was all informed by what Watford were incapable of doing. I mean, the two set piece goals they conceded before half time were just nonsense. And the third goal, I understand Watford's situation, the importance of trying to take 3 points from that game with, you know, West Ham being dragged back by Brighton and everything. But there's no defence for it. It's interesting because obviously I think they came to that game unbeaten in 7 games or 1 defeat in 7 or something like that, which is a big uptick under Nigel Pearson. It's interesting just how quickly all the old neuroses came flooding back as soon as those two goals went in, because they were great for 40 minutes. They played really well, Watford. And Everton, who look like they're probably going to be safe, they looked almost disinterested. And at that point, you would say there's not enough heart in this team for a comeback to be even possible. But it happened, and Nigel Pearson did that thing in his press conference where he says the right words, but in a weird sort of tone where you think he might be about to leap over the desk and punch whoever asked the question. Do you want to say, actually, there was Speedo Mick at Vicarage Road.
He's fantastic.
He's, for people who don't know, that's a proper hero. He's 650 miles into his walk from Land's End, from John O'Groats to Land's End. And I think he's raised like 170 grand. And he's doing it in speedos as well. Looked absolutely freezing, Mick, and probably about 10 pounds lighter than his Twitter profile picture. But he's doing amazing work. It's always good to see him at football. It's brilliant.
Yeah, and he was well received by both sets of fans, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
Which actually sums up Watford as a family club. You know, that we use that sometimes as a bit of a cliche. Is that going to be enough, that sort of feel-good factor? Is that going to wane as the season goes on, do you think?
Well, it helps that Vicarage Road is a really good place to watch football nowadays. Better than it probably ever has been, actually. It's nice and enclosed and tight, and it's got a good feel about it. When the momentum is with them, as it certainly was in the start of Pearson's reign until, probably until this weekend, they've had a couple of defeats, haven't they, recently? And you just feel, once that momentum starts to slip, they've had that surge, got themselves out of the bottom three, and now if you lose that momentum, you wonder, because the club, the team wouldn't have been way adrift at the bottom if they were outstanding. They've been punching above their weight under Pearson. They were punching below it under Sanchez Flores before that. So I think they've probably got enough individual quality there. And I always like the midfielders, Decore and Caputo, those sort of player Caputo in a team of Watford size. I think they're really, really good players that can drag you over the line in a relegation battle. I think they'll probably just about get out of it. Just that is a worry, the nature of Saturday's game, that you can just lose that momentum. Pearson knows all about the momentum of that late Leicester run to stay up the year before the title season under Pearson was extraordinary. And it was so much about momentum and belief, and that when you lose it, you then do start to fear maybe a little.
Mm. Given that they've got to do something at Brighton on Saturday, what do you make of Brighton under Graham Potter?
Bit of a mixed bag. I like the way they play. Like, I've got all the respect in the world for Chris Hughton. I think he's a lovely guy, and he did great things to keep them up. And I feel like he's been disrespected a little bit by losing his job. That being said, I feel like there's been an obvious departure both in the style and the nature of the recruiting. Obviously, Graham Potter's been going through some pretty difficult personal circumstances, and I feel, whilst I didn't know that before, looking back at what's been going on at the club and the sort of the sequence of results, perhaps that's bled into performances, and completely understandably. But I was really humbled by their comeback at West Ham. You just think, do Brighton last year, do they have the gears to play like that in pursuit of a two-goal deficit? Probably not. So I think they're a more dexterous side. I think they're interesting. I think I like the idea of having someone like Dan Ashworth there, because I think he sort of represents the kind of the pursuit of a younger type of player, a sort of a greater longevity in recruiting. So interesting. They're not just here to stabilise themselves and finish 17th every season. They've got a kind of an ambition to grow and develop and evolve. And it's a good enough reason to watch them.
Mm. When we talk about ambition and Newcastle, we just think about Mike Ashley and his determination to get top dollar for his football club, or what he perceives to be his football club. They've had a poor window again. They've got Oxford in the cup. Again, a little bit like Spurs. Is this a game that they have to win to rejuvenate their season?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Newcastle's far too big a club not to have won a trophy for five decades.
Five.
The Bears come in 69, so over five decades. And as we were sort of mentioning about Mourinho and Spurs, there's huge value there in terms of even a cup run, never mind actually winning a cup. For Newcastle's support, I think Bruce seems to get that. I think there's been times under Ashley that they really have thrown away the cup and put out very weak sides. But Oxford away will be tough for them. I think I didn't expect them to go bananas and spend loads of money in January. I think Rose is a good signing for them. I think it was a good signing for Spurs. It was a good deal for Rose, for Spurs and for Newcastle, that one. They didn't seem to want him there. He needs football to try and get into the England squad, and I think he'll do a good job for Newcastle if he gets himself fit and playing every week. So I thought that was one decent upside for Newcastle. But yeah, you sort of fear for that in that Oxford tie that it's the sort of one that they've tended to lose over the years. I think there's a little bit more focus on the Cup in a positive way, and the fact that they're not, although they're not entirely safe, they're much more safe than they normally are at the stage of the season. They normally start off back very badly and end up, you know, having a scrap for the second half of the season to stay up, don't they? And that's not the case this year, so they should be able to focus more on the Cup. I think I'm right in saying that they've got another lower league team if they were to beat Oxford, so there's a real path towards the quarterfinals there, and that's something Newcastle haven't had for many years.
Mm. Just want to end, Seb, if I may, by looking at the winter break.
Yeah.
Pretty underwhelming, to be perfectly honest, at the moment. How can it be refined so that it actually does the job that it's meant to do?
It has to be a proper winter break. Because it's not, though, is it? It's like a sort of a winter break, which is like a dumping ground for replays if you need it. I mean, I think the idea is to sort of to create a period of 13 uninterrupted days, whereas in reality, like, it's not sacrosanct. You know, if the determination is to actually have a winter break and to extract the benefits other European leagues do from it, other European clubs and players, then you actually have to make it one. You know, it's kind of, well, we want to have one, but not in a way which interrupts our TV schedule. So we're going to put, you know, we've got five television games coming up on of this weekend, five television games next. So you kind of, it's a compromise between what's always worked and what television companies and the league and the clubs want and the revenue, and this increasing issue with the health and performance and condition of players. It's too much football. It's just too much football. It's inarguable. I don't know what the solution is to that because I'm not smart enough. And then it's not my job to find a solution for that. But inarguably, there is a problem with how much players are playing and what stresses we're placing on them. It's got to...
Because they're falling over like flies, aren't they? You know, there's Sterling. You know, yeah. He's the latest one to go. Yeah.
I think... you know, you've got to scrap cup replays. For me, they make cup upsets, you know, less likely rather than more likely than having a shootout. It goes against the grain. It's just, I do sympathise with Guardiola, who keeps winning the League Cup and then talks about wanting to abolish it. I think maybe that would be a way of finding more breathing room in the overall fixture list, which would then allow the FA Cup to breathe more.
Yeah.
And give it a better focus, because there's always the problem with the cup that it's the third round comes after five Premier League games are played in 10 days, or
the busiest time of the year. Stop sort of creating like 90 team Club World Cups adding new layers to international football and making players travel for thousands of miles across time zones once a month. It's got to be, eventually the pursuit of money has got to be tempered by recognition of what is being done to the game.
Well, here's an idea. Scrap one of the early international breaks, play the FA Cup third round on New Year's Day, and for heaven's sake, give the players a proper rest. Thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.